Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 344 with my guest, Sarah Sterling. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads. From medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction, to everyday compulsive negative thinking. The show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist. It's not a doctor's office. Turn around and leave if you think this was a doctor's office. Why am I attacking the kind listener right out of the gate? Because I hate myself. That's why. Because I feel less than. Oh, let's not go down this rabbit hole. Hey, our website is mentalpod.com. Go there, fill out a survey. A big part of this show is reading surveys. And I know we've been a little bit light on them lately. It's because I've been trying to find a place to live. As I mentioned, I'm getting booted out of this apartment. And I've also been looking for maybe another apartment to live in, maybe trying to find a house to live in, and I still haven't decided, and I have to move in 5 days. So it's a little crazy. So we should be back to our kind of our regular routine, hopefully in a couple of weeks, but there will still be episodes every Friday morning. So what did I want to mention? Oh, we finally fixed the search engine or the search tool on our website to make it easier to find older episodes. It was really laborious for people to have to find episodes from 4 or 5 years back, and there was no really good way to do it. It was so laborious that the government was beginning to sentence criminals to searching for episodes from 2013. And then they appealed, and an appeals court found it unusually inhumane to make people do that. So I contacted our web guy and said, listen, we got to change this. And so we did. And so now there's a drop-down menu, and you can pick a year and month to kind of drop into the scrolling back and forth for episodes. So hopefully that'll make it easier. And if not, go fuck yourself. Somebody emailed me and they said, we haven't heard you tell us to go fuck ourselves in a while. So there you go. Thank you for the British listeners who pointed out that the British word for flashlight is torch. From last week's episode, I thought that the headmaster she was talking about was actually carrying a torch, which made it so dramatic, but it's still dramatic. We have a winner for our LA Podfest hotel and ticket winner. And it is Grace, who has been a subscriber for a while on the podcast. I don't know if she wants her last name mentioned yet, so I emailed her, but haven't heard back whether or not she wants her last name mentioned. I know this is very tense. Rest assured, I will we'll get you a last name. I was talking to my therapist last Friday, and I stumbled upon how uncomfortable I am in asking people to do things for me and how afraid I am of having needs. You know, on last week's episode, we talked about how my therapist had me take this test, which is called the Language of Love, and you find out by taking this test, which ways of expressing and receiving love do you put the most value on? For instance, actions or words or physical touch or being helped, et cetera, et cetera. And as I mentioned on last week's episode, the two top ways that I enjoy receiving love are by people helping me and by spending quality time and having someone's undivided attention. And I realized those are two things I almost never do. And I was like, why do I avoid giving people an opportunity to love me? And I realized it's because I am afraid of looking needy. I am afraid of having needs. And I don't know where it comes from. Maybe it comes from in childhood, for some reason, maybe I was afraid to have needs. Maybe I was just so focused on other people's needs that I didn't even know what my needs were. But one of the ways that I have coped with this fear is it's so gross. My ex-wife used to point this out to me. Instead of coming right out and saying, hey, could you go start cooking the spaghetti for me. I would say, boy, I wonder what traffic's going to be like on that way over to that place in 20 minutes. It's like I leave a trail of clues in the hopes that the person will do the math and realize that I have a need to be filled. And it used to drive my ex-wife crazy. And she would just say, just fucking ask for something. But I'm so afraid of looking needy. And yet I can be needy. Oh, I shouldn't put this on you. I'm a piece of work. But enough about me. Let me tell you about our sponsor, BetterHelp.com. I love them. I've been using BetterHelp.com for a year, and I love my therapist. Her name is Donna Keene. She's awesome. Talk to her every Friday. We do a video to video, and I get so much out of it. She gives me a lot of clarity on stuff, and she's big on bringing it back to the present moment and staying in the moment, which is all we really ever have. So if you want to check out BetterHelp.com, go to BetterHelp.com/mental. And it's important you put the /mental in there because then they'll know you came from us and hopefully they'll continue to advertise with us. So go there, complete a questionnaire, and then they'll match you with a BetterHelp.com counselor, and you can experience a free week of counseling to see if online counseling is right for you. And you need to be 18 years or older. Oh, and not older than 137, but that hasn't been a problem yet. I want to read a survey. This is an awfulsome moment survey, and this was filled out by Daniel, and he writes, I had my first depressive episode in my mid-20s. It was pretty severe. It got to the point where I wasn't able to get out of bed to go to work, and I would just sleep all day. I finally realized I needed help and sought treatment. I decided to tell my parents what I was going through in the hope that they would help support me through this rough time. When I called my mom and told her that I had started seeing a doctor to help me with depression, her response was simply, well, I just hope they don't tell you it was our fault.
I'm so scared of being alive and so scared of dying. I was so, so lonely, but I couldn't bear being around people, and it hurt.
I've just been, like, very interested in dicks.
I don't know how to let loose and just be.
All my alters have different handwriting, different...
Extremely anxious.
Affects.
I am most turned on when I am in fear.
My first thought was I'm about to die.
Stomach clutching despair.
Ocean of sadness.
I came out over the phone to them.
I put myself on the Atkins diet in fourth grade.
They told me I was wrong.
The secrecy is what kills us.
And I just sat there and cried on his shoulder.
And it was the first time I ever felt safe, like a weight lifted off of me.
In order to get rid of your anger, you have to learn how to cry.
I started liking myself for the first time.
I'm afraid that people are only nice to me because they're afraid I'll kill myself if they're not.
Oh, that's fantastic. That is fantastic.
I'm here with Sarah Sterling, who was recommended to me by a listener. And listeners usually have a pretty good sense of somebody that would be a good guest for the show. You're a YouTube artist. You talk about all things Disney. It's interesting. My first reaction was, wow, does this person have enough issues to to talk about on the podcast? And then I realized, oh, anybody that loves Disney has got to be fucked up.
Oh, my God. That's probably true.
No. No, I'm not a huge Disney fan, and I'm fucked up. So there goes my theory. Actually, that's not true. When I was a kid, some of the Disney stuff I totally love.
Yeah, I feel like everyone has to love it at least a little bit.
Yeah.
Some part of
before you hate it.
Right.
What are the broad... So we exchanged emails, and I said, you know, if you were to come on as a guest, what are some of the broad strokes of your stories or issues that you would like to talk about? And you said... do you remember what you said?
I don't actually. Okay. So long ago at this point. I assume I probably talked about a terrible relationship I had.
I think that was one of them. And I think the other thing you said was that there was something that you hadn't really talked about much yet. And you were considering, you had been wanting to kind of talk about initial, I don't know if it was anxiety or depression. Or...
Oh, yeah. I have started talking about my anxiety issues more and more on YouTube. So I'm not sure if it was that because I have been, maybe not at the time that we corresponded. I hadn't been talking about it yet. But
I also smoked so much weed in my day. I may be mistaking you with somebody else.
Yeah.
So where would be a... So anxiety.
Yes.
You got out of a terrible relationship.
I had a relationship that I think causes a lot of the issues that I deal with today.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think would be the best way to proceed? One of the things that I like to do, I know you've listened to a few episodes, but one of the things that I like to do is kind of understand a little bit where somebody comes from, kind of where were they, what was the emotional environment like that they were raised in, issues they may have had as a kid.
We'll start from the very beginning.
Let's do that. And you're how old?
I'm 26.
Okay.
Yeah. So I grew up in L.A. I've never had a desire to leave, so I've always stayed here, all over the city. And I'm like, how do I begin? I'm like, what issues do I start with? I was a very happy kid. I don't think I had a bad childhood at all. My parents got divorced when I was 8, and even that
was it amicable?
Yes, very amicable, and they made it very easy for us. I don't remember a moment of being upset about it.
Wow.
Yeah, my sisters, I think, maybe had a harder time because I'm the youngest. I have two older sisters. And so that typically would probably cause some issues, but for me, it was very easy, and I feel very lucky about that. More difficult later in life was my dad getting remarried when I was 12. Not for any reason other than living with a new person proved to be somewhat challenging when I was like a teenager.
Because it was anybody or that person in particular?
I think it would have been hard with anybody, but my stepmother in particular is a very particular person. I don't want to speak poorly of her because I do really like... I like her and we get along now, but as soon as I went to college, we got along a lot better. But she... I think she even would agree with like me saying that she is very... particular. She likes things the way she likes things. She had a lot of rules that I wasn't used to. And so that was somewhat difficult. in terms of the divorce. I got a half, I'm like, I could call him a half brother. He's technically a stepbrother out of the situation, but my brother was adopted single by my stepmother. And so my dad is like his only dad that he's ever had. So I like, it's really tough for me to even call him a stepbrother because he's just very much my brother. So those were like the biggest challenges pre being 16. Then I met the guy that I ended up being with for 4 or 5 years when I was 16. And he was 24. So that is like the crux of...
You were 16 and he was 24.
Yes. Your look says everything. So I've talked about this entire experience online, but I stopped talking about it maybe a couple years ago. Just like, I mean, I don't entirely agree with my own reasons for not talking about it, which is why I'm like pretty pumped to talk about it here. I think messy situations can make, well, I like wanted to use the word messy to describe myself. I think that situations like mine can make a person seem messy. And so that's why I don't talk about it a lot. But
and why the reticence to seem messy?
Just for like professional purposes.
I see.
It's really stupid, I think, that experiences can make a person seem less desirable to work with because of things that have happened in their past, because it's really not uncommon what happened to me, and like a lot of other situations are not uncommon. But that is why I've like kept it kind of, I don't keep it quiet, I just like don't really talk about it.
I see.
Anymore.
Before we get to that,
I get out of breath when I like
I'm deep like, breaths. Yeah. Deep breaths. Before we get to the relationship, give me some snapshots from childhood or adolescence, things that you feel are emblematic, positively or negatively, of kind of your emotional life, self-beliefs, how you viewed the world, any of the above.
My family is very liberal and pretty accepting of like whatever I wanted to do. Like, I don't feel like I was ever forced to do things I didn't want to do. I think my parents tried to get me to play sports and I didn't want to play sports, and that was like the only thing that I can remember them trying to force me into. I'm the youngest of two sisters, and I'm also the youngest of like six total female cousins. My family is very like all women, and that was like kind of very now I appreciate it a lot. I don't think I even really realized it as a kid. My mom is
Did you feel left behind as a kid? Because everybody was older and was talking about things you didn't really understand?
For like a short period of time. Okay. Just because like, I mean, the next age difference in my family would be 3 years between me and my cousin that's closest in age to me. And she really hated being like paired with me all the time.
That's a pretty big difference though for a kid.
Right. I mean, it's like when she's like nine and I'm still six, she like didn't want to hang out with me. I don't think she wanted to hang out with me until I was like 14 probably. But I mean, they were all very, no one was ever mean to me. Yeah. And I was going to say, my mom is really overprotective. I feel like I've definitely picked up a lot of her tendencies to fear situations. Like
kind of a worst case scenario.
Maybe not even like worst case scenario. She just like was always kind of like, I have a lot of memories of her talking to me about like, what do you do if someone like attacks you in your car? Like, what do you do if like you're choking on something alone at home? What do you do if someone like says they have a puppy they want to show you like after school?
So kind like of testing you?
Yes. And I appreciate it, but also like definitely didn't make me worried as a kid, but I think has changed me as an adult.
When she would ask you this, was there a bare bulb on a chain in an empty room?
No, it sounds like that. I feel like it was always in the car, like we always just like on long drives or something. She was worse with my older sisters, I think by the, which is funny because it was still kind of intense, but by the time she got to me, it was less intense. Because I remember, I don't know if you're familiar with the Third Street Promenade, probably. Yeah, so we grew up in Santa Monica, and so she made my sister, like literally tested my sister before she was allowed to hang out on the promenade alone in middle school. She would walk the promenade and like point out any possible dangers and then have my sister walk the promenade. And if she didn't see everything my mom had seen, she wasn't ready to go the promenade alone.
Wow, that's pretty intense. And for the listeners, the Third Street Promenade is a outdoor mall very close to the ocean in Santa Monica in Los Angeles, and very, very popular. Can be very crowded.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's also an element of how do I put it, in Santa Monica, of drifters, homeless people, some untreated mental illness, and as Harry Shearer calls it, Santa Monica, the home of the homeless.
Yeah.
but a really nice area, but certainly fraught with pockets of unpredictability.
Sure. So I'm glad she'll never hear this because she would kill me for talking about it. But yeah, so I mean, I think that is the most like part of my childhood that has affected me as an adult. I think I'm very, I don't worry about a lot of situations, but I think I'm very, maybe like more careful than other people. And I kind of get a little bit anxious when I feel out of control, and I think it's all kind of like from her, maybe. I like don't want to blame her, but I mean, whatever. So yeah, I think in terms of like childhood.
Do you get anxious sometimes when you come to her to share some part of your life for fear that she's going to scrutinize it in a way that may take some of the joy out of it? And that's a dynamic that I see sometimes in parents that are worry warts.
No, I think what's great is that I've always kind of been, out of my sisters at least, out of my cousins as well, like the weird one. I don't, that's a very generic word to use for it, but I've always kind of, like, no one ever knew what I was going to grow up to do. And like, I was interested in a lot of different things that weren't really being done yet. Like, I was editing videos when I was like in the sixth grade, which at the time, like, I don't think YouTube even existed then, like stuff like that. So it's like now it's obvious like what I would end up doing, but at the time, not very obvious. And so my mom was always super supportive of everything I was into. And I think in college, before like YouTube was a, I'm using air quotes, career, she was kind of like, what are you doing? But like now is very supportive of it all. And I don't worry about telling her anything. I think I'm protective of her. Like, I'm very careful in the way that I do say certain things to her because she can get very emotional, as can I. It's like I probably get it from her. But I've talked a lot to my therapist about how, like, I keep a lot of things maybe from her because I don't want her to, like, freak out, because she will freak out when there's nothing to freak out about. So that's a different sort of thing that I think you were asking.
Right.
But
just a kind of a different emotional anticipation of what would,
if I'm like dealing with something, I might not talk to her about it because she'll just worry about it for way longer than it's even going to be happening.
Yeah.
Type of thing.
Yeah. I see that. I see that happen a lot, a lot with people. The well-meaning parent that kind of doesn't really know how to have their brain wind down or where to kind of let the child loose to make their own mistakes.
Mm-hmm. She recently talked to me about a couple videos I've made about my anxiety issues, because I have started talking about it a little bit more on my YouTube channel. And she was like, I'm a little bit concerned because the way you talk about it makes it sound like somewhat debilitating, and that's not like how I see you. And I'm like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, it's not like, I'm like, I'm living my life and I'm fine, but like, it's all kind of internal and I'm like making it external. And she's like, okay. I think it freaks her out. Not only that I talk about it, but that she's like, where is this coming from? And is it my fault? And like all these different things, but she's been okay about it. So yeah.
It's gotta be hard to be a parent. It's gotta be really, really hard to understand where does protection and independence begin for a kid. I can't imagine how baffling and challenging that must be.
Definitely.
So fast forward to, unless there were other little moments you wanted to share that you feel kind of...
I mean, I feel like there's potentially a lot I could touch on, but I don't think anything is super important to go into. So
you want to just give me maybe two more, and
yeah, it came to mind that I was like scared of my dad as a kid for mm-hmm. no reason. I don't think he, like, now that I'm an adult, I see him as like a total goofball, but he's very quiet and reserved, as is his whole side of the family, and I think I have some of those tendencies, but as a kid I think I was just really scared of him because I didn't know him very well. Mm-hmm. And he worked a lot, so there's that. And I really feel like that's it. I think there's like some moments in my like adolescence where both my sisters were super like up for valedictorian, like straight A students, and I was not a bad student, but I think for a short period of time in middle school, I felt like I had to live up to that. And then I did not feel that way at all in high school anymore. I was like, I'm different and that's fine. So I'm rolling with it. So.
And were grades treated as like by your parents? Was it this is expected of you? There's no wiggle room, or we just want you to try as hard as you can, and whatever the result may be, we love you and support you.
I think the latter. As long as I was applying myself, I think they were happy. There were times where I think they knew I wasn't trying my best, and that's when they were upset. But honestly, I wasn't a terrible student, but it's just like by the time I was applying for college, they were just like, well, you know, like, be realistic about where you're going to go. And like, they were fine with it, but, you know, kind of understood where I was at.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how did this relationship come about?
It's kind of funny just mm-hmm. because it's so nerdy. I have like all my Disney stuff, but before the Disney stuff, there was Harry Potter, which I'm so obsessed with and have been mm-hmm. since I was in the eighth grade, or when I was eight, sorry, mm-hmm. not the eighth grade. So like I grew up loving Harry Potter, being so obsessed with it. And then I don't know if you're into Harry Potter. Are you?
I read the first book and it wasn't anything where I was like, I can't wait to read the next book, but I can absolutely see how somebody mm-hmm. could just want to escape into as much of it as possible.
Sure.
Before we move on past the Harry Potter stuff,
it's all related, I promise.
Okay. I was going to ask you if you could inject yourself into any scene or Harry Potter situation or be any character or view any Harry Potter moment as a fly on the wall, et cetera, et cetera. What would that be? Your real life and the Harry Potter world mixing, what are some things that spring to mind?
Oh my God, I've like never thought about this. I've obviously thought about like being like, what would it be like to have magic and like go to Hogwarts, but I've never like thought about who I have favorite characters, but I don't think I'd want to be them. I'm like, what Harry Potter moment?
Well, you could talk about the thing that you thought about as well. What it'd be like to have magic and go to Hogwarts.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you envision or fantasize?
I'm very like into my house association. Like everybody who's into Harry Potter, even people who are not, I think like maybe think about what house they would be in if they went to Hogwarts. And I'm very like adamantly Hufflepuff, which to you probably means absolutely nothing. But Hufflepuffs in the movies are like pretty ignored. And so I think in pop culture terms, it's like the forgotten house that nobody even really thinks about, even though I think they're having like a popular resurgence now. But they're not really paid much attention to. There's like two prominent characters in the books that are Hufflepuffs. And so it's really the book fans who I think really love Hufflepuff and like associate with being in that house. And I'm one of them. They're very loyal and can be very tenacious is like another word to describe them, but hardworking. I associate myself with Hufflepuff because I think that I am very aggressive, but only when it comes to like righteousness and also sticking up for people. So yeah. that's
That sounds like a good house. So
they're great.
would it be fair to say that they can tend to be underestimated for their strength and what's really going on inside them, but because they aren't the ones that want all the accolades, they are fine with who they are, and they believe that their fate will, ultimately what's inside them will determine their destiny rather than what people think of them.
I think you could definitely say that. There's a lot of different types of people who could still be in all of the four houses, but those are just the reasons why I feel like I'm in that house.
But have you in your life felt like you've been overlooked?
Not necessarily. I think that I'm someone who likes being the center of attention when I want to be the center of attention, which is not always. So it's like, when I want something, I'm going to do what I need to do to get there or get it. And then other times I just like want to be completely alone.
And would it be fair to say that the moments when you do want to seek attention, it's because you have something you want to express or because you just want to be seen?
It could be either. Okay. I think sometimes it definitely is just wanting to have attention.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you think of a moment in your life where you felt you're like a intense desire inside yourself to be seen and it felt unmet?
I think all through high school, I did a lot of things that were like somewhat ridiculous just to be noticed. I like always talk about how I was teased in high school, but I don't think it was, I don't think it really affected me negatively. What I always like tell people, because I get a lot of people talking to me about how they're also teased for liking Disney or whatever it is that they love. When people would make fun of me for stuff, I really just was pushed to like throw it back at them more. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's kind of, it was probably me turning like negative attention into just like more attention of any kind. It's like, if someone's going to hate me or make fun of me for just liking whatever I like, then I'm just going to like it harder in their face. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that's pretty badass.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like being teased in middle school did make me really upset, but then I kind of just figured out my own way to turn it into something else.
Yeah. And it was your tastes that were the reason you were...
Yeah,
you
like, were... liking Disney and, like, being really into Disney stuff was just, like, too bizarre for people, apparently.
That strikes me as odd. It's like, isn't that the age that people are supposed to like that, or was that
not
considered
in high
too
school?
Late?
I think it's for younger. But with Harry Potter too, I just like, I wore wizard robes to school like way too often, just because I was like, if you're gonna think it's weird, then I'm just gonna be weirder for
you.
You
wore a wizard robe to high school,
not like all the time. Like I tried to only do it on spirit days, but there are definitely days.
I'm gonna say one time is memorable. But and I don't mean this condescendingly, but good for you.
Thank you.
Good for you. I wanted to be that. Like, I wanted to be a theater student in high school, but I didn't have the guts to do it because I was afraid of being labeled something, of being with the kids who fearlessly express themselves. And so I tip of the hat.
Thanks.
Yeah. Tip of the wizard cap to you.
Yeah, tip of the sorting hat.
Okay, so magical powers, you would be in that house.
Yeah. I've thought about like which classes I would enjoy the most. I think it would be charms. For I don't really know what reason. I feel like charms is like the most useful spells. I've thought about like if I would play Quidditch, I definitely would not.
Is that the broom thing?
Yeah, it's like I don't like sports in this reality, and I wouldn't like sports in that reality either. I've mostly just thought about like we don't get to this is so. Meta. It's not meta. It's just like getting deep into it with someone who doesn't really know the books. I'm like, have thought a lot about what the Hufflepuff common room looks like because we don't actually get to go into it in the books. So I've thought a lot about that.
Describe it.
Well, they're by the kitchens. That's the only thing we know from the books is that they're next to the kitchens. And I imagine it to be very yellow because that's the Hufflepuff color. And just like cozy and warm because that's how Hufflepuffs feel to me. Gryffindor common room, it feels very similar to that, except less gothic in my mind. But that might be the movies informing my vision of what all of it looks like. So
I appreciate you sharing all this stuff.
Sure.
It's a really fascinating way for me to try to understand somebody's inner life,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to just talking about events. Because yeah. I think a lot of times fantasy is a peek into the subconscious. Mm-hmm. You know, I had this fantasy when I was like 14 or 15, and I, all of a sudden, the people that I'd been friends with as kids went to a different high school. Everybody was hitting puberty and growing, and I wasn't, and I just felt left in the dust. And I started smoking pot, and I remember just the feeling of escape from it. And I would fantasize that I could get high. Did you ever watch I Dream of Jeannie?
A little bit.
You know, in her bottle, how mm-hmm. it had all those pillows?
Yeah.
It would be like a sphere like that, but totally clear, and it had all those pillows, and it would just be me, and I could get high in it, and it would be chained. It would have a chain on the bottom of the sphere, chained to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, and I would be able to bob up and down in the middle of the most violent storm, and I would be safe from it, and I could just watch chaos all around me, but I would be protected. And of course, now I look back and it was like, oh, you know, there was chaos in right. my house. I just couldn't give words to it. So that, I think fantasy can be really
mm-hmm.
there's a word.
Yeah,
no. Illustrative?
Yeah, that works.
Okay. So go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, the Harry Potter stuff was always there. But then in high school, I started learning about this thing called wizard rock, which is a musical genre of just music written about Harry Potter. So there was like a lot of bands that were like cropping up who were just writing songs about Harry Potter. But like, it's so hard to explain because it's like really good music, but it sounds so funny. But it's like if you had an actual pop song or rock song or punk song, but the lyrics were just like about Harry Potter. And I was obsessed. I thought it was like the greatest thing. And so when the 7th book was coming out, I was like figuring out where I was going to go to the midnight release of the book, because I had been doing that since like the 5th book, going to the midnight movies and all of that. So my decision was informed by the fact that one of these bands was going to be playing at a Barnes & Noble in LA. And I was like, oh my God, I could see a Wizard Rock show live, and like was really into this particular band.
And did you have a group of friends that were into it as well? So you had a community, or was this kind of a solo thing for you?
I didn't quite. My older sister, Rachel, has always also been into Harry Potter, but she wasn't really like doing it with me then. She got really into like the fandom with me later, and is like now in it. I'm still in it, mm-hmm. and so is she. I didn't go alone. I went with like family friends who were just like, this seems fun, I'm like gonna go with you. And the same like night, I still like consider it like the beginning of my involvement in the Harry Potter fandom, because I met a lot of people that night who like influenced me to go to Harry Potter conventions after that point. And like, I talked to them online about Harry Potter stuff. It's just like the first night that I like met people who were into it on the level that I was. So
did you feel like you'd found your people?
Yeah, maybe not that night, but like it all stemmed from that night.
Okay, so you found some degree of acceptance yeah. there.
I mean, I think the reason why I loved the midnight releases so much is because it's like, who else except the most hardcore fans are going to that kind of thing? Yeah. So that's why I kept having these like moments where I was going to these midnight releases or premieres of movies yeah. and being like, this is a taste of like what it would be like to be surrounded mm-hmm. by people who love it. So anyway, I go to Barnes & Noble and this band is playing, and the lead singer is the guy I would end up being in this relationship with. So that's when I met him. He was the lead singer of a band. I don't even care to mention it. It's called the Remus Lupins. Mm-hmm. They were all dumb names like that, based off Harry Potter characters. So I met him that night. I was 16. He was 24. He started talking to me after that point, like, on MySpace probably, and then, like, on AOL Instant Messenger. And he lived in L.A., and so it's just, like, started with a lot of him, like, saying inappropriate things to me. At the time, I didn't realize they were inappropriate. Like, I mean, I probably did on some level, because he was saying stuff like, oh, I wish you weren't 16, and, like, gross stuff like that. But we would hang out a lot more in group settings because it was easier to explain to my parents, but obviously there was a lot of lying that started to happen at that point.
And you were a sophomore, junior?
I must have been. It was in the summer, probably before my junior year, that I met him. Yeah. So I'm like, I don't even know, like, how to chronologically explain this relationship, but there was just a lot of us, like, hanging out and kind of sneaking around. And because I wasn't 18, there was kind of always this, like, looming, like, this can never be a thing because, like, it's not legal for it to be, like, a real thing.
Right. Was it something that you, in your 16-year-old brain, longed for?
Yes. Like, I was like, this feels awesome, like, getting attention from this older person. Like, he's really cool in this scene, and I'm beginning to be cool in the scene, and I'm not cool in high school. This feels great, you know, like, all that stuff. So it was very addicting. I definitely put up with a lot of stuff because it felt good to have some sort of status and to, like, be liked by this person.
Like, what kind of stuff did you put up with?
Oh, well, he was just, like, terrible. Like, I mean, I think it goes without saying that, like, any 24-year-old who, like, pursues a 16-year-old is terrible. But, like, he was also very manipulative. Mm-hmm. And, like, I mean, he was always the one who was just like, well, you can't be my girlfriend because you're not 18. And strung me along until I was 18. And then even then, like, was not, like, a good boyfriend or exclusive to me at all. I would go to conventions, Harry Potter conventions that he was at, and he would be very mean to me, like, when other people were present, and, like, nice to me when no one was around, type of thing. It's like,
wait, say that again? He was mean to you when people were around, but nice when no one was around?
Basically, yes.
I would think it would be the other way.
Right. I mean, it's just like, I think there were so many girls that he was also pursuing and interacting with that could have been around at any given moment. I probably don't even know, like, all of the people involved with his, like, nonsense. And so, like, when I think he would choose on different days or nights, like, who he would be, like, nice to, and then everyone else he was, like, very standoffish to, but, like, kept them strung along privately, mm-hmm. so as not to, like, cut off that relationship. Sorry. So, I mean, I was just kind of dealing with that from ages, like, 16 to 18.
But nothing happened before your 18th birthday physically.
It did, is the thing. And that he was always very much like, I'm not going to have sex with you until you're 18. But, like, there's a lot of different, like, sex can be defined very differently. And by a lot of definitions, it still definitely was sex. So, lots of, I mean, I don't know how explicit I can get.
you can share freely on the podcast.
Lots of, like, basically everything except vaginal penetration. It's fair game. So, like, I think as a 16, 17 year old, I was like, it's not sex, you know, but now as an adult, I'm like, it was sex. So, he was trying to cover his ass in terms of, like, definitions of sex, but it definitely, like, was not okay. Yeah. So,
and what do you think, looking, and maybe this is too soon to ask you this question at this point in your unrolling the story,
sure,
but what do you think as you look back now?
What
feelings come up? It sounds like anger.
Yes. Yeah, I have a lot of, like, I'm still angry at him, even though, like, this will come up later, of, like, done everything I can to, like, make sure that he doesn't do this to other people. But I definitely consider it sexual assault. That's like a given. Like, I think a lot of people get upset if I call it rape, but like, because it wasn't violent and because I was quote unquote consenting, but I look back at like my mindset as a teenager and I'm like, there's no way I could really have consented at the time because there was like a huge power imbalance and I wasn't not making informed decisions, but like I wasn't making decisions with a sound mind.
Yeah.
So that's how I look back on it.
Yeah, it's kind of emotionally coercive.
Very. Yeah. When I was 18, I was like, I'm 18 now, we should be together. And even then, like, it wasn't really anywhere near like a good committed relationship. Then I feel like I truly forget like the order of things, but there was a point where he was very publicly my boyfriend, and I don't really remember when that happened. I remember probably giving him some sort of ultimatum and being like, this is messed up, like you said when I was 18, that kind of thing. But I don't really remember the conversation. And then there was a lot of like him cheating, like during, even after he was like okay and being very public. And I do remember the conversation when I'm struggling to like remember the order of things as I like say it to you. There was later like when I finally did break up with him, but then I remember a conversation when I was probably trying to break up with him where I like so vividly remember him saying like, you know, you're never gonna find someone who's as good for you as I am. Wow. Yeah, terrible. But at that point I did say to him like, well then like the world is messed up if I can't find someone better than you. But still stayed with him for at least a little bit after that point. I broke up with him when I went to go work at Disneyland. So
there's so many so many terrible jokes in
right.
there, so many ironies, so much awfulsome. That's a word we use on the podcast. Something that is awful at the time, but you look back on it and there's something so sickly fucked up about it, you can't help but kind of laugh.
No, I definitely laugh about it a lot with like the women who were like friends with him or like involved with him at the time. Like we all definitely laugh about it a lot now in a very twisted way. I broke up with him when I was about to go work at Disney because I was a part of this program. And I, like, really wanted to, like, fully experience it. I feel like in college, I was always, like, coming back to the West Side. I went to college on the East Side of LA. Kept, like, just, like, missing a lot of things because I was, like, just trying to spend time with him. I was very paranoid about time that I wasn't spending with him because he could be doing, like, whatever. That definitely is still, like, something that I think about in my current relationship, which sucks so much. I'm always, like... And I'm very open with my boyfriend now where I'm like, can you like text me when you're out? Because I'm like, have this like paranoia that you're going to cheat on me, which he hasn't. So anyway, I didn't want that to continue when I went to Disney. And so I was like, you know what? I think we should take a break. And at that point, he basically started seeing a very good friend of both of ours who he had always like very clearly been interested in like the entire time I knew him. And that really sucked and like was hard for like a long time, especially it's like a sitcom basically, because like she and I were like living in the same apartment complex at the time and he was like coming to Anaheim to like see her, but I was also there, felt very weird about it. She and I are very good friends now, so it's all good, but that's when that ended. I feel like I very much skimmed over the entire thing, and it's a lot more like
how much
messed
did
up.
How much did your parents know?
Like none of this. When I talked about protecting my mom,
yeah,
this is kind of like the biggest thing.
Okay,
yeah.
And do they know about it now?
No.
Okay.
Not really. They knew about him when I started like officially and openly dating him.
But they didn't know that he had been telling you since you were 16.
No.
You know?
No. They, like, knew...
Or that you were doing things with him
no,
when you were 16.
No, definitely not. They knew who he was before we were, like, openly dating. But it was always like either me sneaking around or me like kind of making it okay by like, oh, a lot of people are going to be there, things like that. So they like knew him. And I think my mom was always very uncomfortable with the idea of me hanging out with like older people, but it kind of was like, it's Harry Potter. Like they're all just
so
like,
innocent.
So yeah, they knew about him after like we were officially dating, but they definitely don't know like everything that happened.
Okay. Let's say they were to hear this episode.
And, <they don't.
laughs> and what would your thoughts and feelings be knowing that you were to meet with your parents in an hour to talk about this?
I would be terrified. I think my dad would be very good about it. My mom would be like an emotional wreck.
Even though it's already done with.
Yeah. I think she would blame herself.
Okay.
For all of it.
And so let's say your mom, you know, you open the door and your mom was hysterical and she was saying, I didn't protect you. I didn't protect you.
I'm going to cry thinking about it. Sorry. I mean, I don't know what I would say, but I do think about this a lot because, I mean, the next part of this story is that I wrote about this very publicly online. And like the number one question I was asked by people is like why I didn't tell the police or like report him in some other way. And like the real reason I didn't is because like I didn't want my mom to know, and I still don't. Yeah. I really didn't. I thought I'd be able to get through this without crying about it, but he had to bring up the mom stuff.
You know, first of all, thank you for being so vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you know, so a couple of thoughts strike me as you're sharing this. Number one is how do I put this into words? How much you care for your mom.
Yeah.
And how much she cares for you, yet there's this kind of this disconnect.
Yeah.
That is kind of heartbreaking because neither of you want to hurt each other.
Right.
You both want the best for each other. But there's this kind of gap. And the question is, how do you fill that gap? And the thought that pops into my head is is to share this with your mom so that you can begin to try to fill that gap. Because until I think she has knowledge of this protectiveness you feel towards her, I don't think she'll be given the opportunity to try to work on it from her end. And if she loves you, she would want to do that. And she seems like the person, type of person that would want to do that. Because it sounds like she loves you.
Yeah. I think that there's a lot of irrational behavior that could stem from a conversation about this sort of stuff. And it's, I don't know. It like, my family is very, like, gossipy. There's also, like, wouldn't really just, like, stay with her probably. I don't know. There's like a lot of things that keep me from having like a conversation with her about it.
Okay.
But I don't think you're wrong.
And I'm not trying to push or pry.
Sure.
I'm just trying be a neutral observer but thank you for going to a place that must be really hard on some days to go back in and talk about. That's
it's so funny because I like think about all this stuff pretty frequently, and I always like have like kind of imaginary conversations about how I would like talk about the entire situation, and it never plays out like it does in my head, and I always cry even though I always feel like I could not cry talking about it. So it's just funny.
When you got choked up
sure.
back there, what were the thoughts or feelings that were going through your head, if there was any conscious?
Probably guilt. I feel guilty because I feel like my mom saw it all coming and I like was a dumb teenager and did what I wanted to do at the time, and now am dealing with that. I think that's like the dominant thing that I feel about it.
But isn't that also some of what teenagers do?
Right. I mean, it's just like my mom got really lucky that she had, I think even me is really good kids. I probably did the worst stuff, but like in the grand scheme of things, still pretty good. Like not doing hard drugs and not being like delinquent in school, like stuff like that. But
And the other thing is I think when you start to blame yourself, you're underestimating the coercion of a 24-year-old brain seducing a 16-year-old brain and right. all the tricks that that person can pull out.
Yeah.
That, you know, how could a mother's stern chat
right compete, stand up to that
compete with 14 in-person encounters with a highly manipulative person that you're smitten with? How could, you know, and it's a little heartbreaking to hear you being so hard on yourself for that, but I also understand that part of that heartbreak is that your mom will feel pain.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, at the root, not even at the root, just like I'm very aware that like it's all of it is his fault and like none of it is my fault. It's really just like the fear of the reaction and like how upset I know she would be and, you know, everything I've kind of said already. It's more just like the me protecting her. Like I just would rather her stay blissfully ignorant of all of it. Mm-hmm. My sister Rachel knows about all of it. Mm-hmm. Both my sisters know about all of it. Neither of my parents do. So it was like hard enough for them to know. And, like, they're very reasonable people who I can have, like, hard conversations with and leave with everyone kind of being able to live their lives unaffected by it. But I don't think my mom would be able to, like, continue her life unaffected by it on the daily. So
that's... You don't think eventually she would get to a place where there would be peace? Right. It's not to say she wouldn't get a twinge of, you know.
Right.
But you don't think it would cripple her ability to function?
I think I don't want to call her like unreasonable or like crazy. I don't like that word even, but like she's the type of person who like until very recently I was positive would send me to rehab if she knew that I had ever smoked weed. Like extreme benign situations.
Okay.
So,
and then what would you say to the fact that you are 26? And you are an adult, and even though she may want those things for you, how does that discussion play out in your mind when you say to yourself, "But you know, Sarah, you're 26, mm-hmm. you're not living under her roof anymore." Do you have that conversation with yourself ever?
Yeah, I do. I think that there's a possibility that when I'm like 40, I could have the conversation with her. But it's like for the foreseeable future, I think that this will continue, that she sees me still as very young because I'm the youngest.
Mm-hmm.
And she trusts my decision making generally less than my sisters, just because I'm the youngest and in her mind I'll always be like a baby. She like got freaked out when I got my very first credit card after college because she was like, you don't know how to handle like paying off, you know, like she just like, and I'm like, I'm also an adult now. Like that kind of conversation. So like I don't know at what point I would feel like she would stop seeing me that way, but for now she still does.
Yeah.
So that's like my hesitancy.
Has your mom ever tried therapy?
Yes. And she even put me in therapy, like, when I was having a lot of frustration about my stepmother and living with my stepmother. And, you know, like, she put both my sisters in therapy when they were getting divorced. She's very, like, pro-therapy, but surprisingly, she's surprisingly concerned with the fact that I'm in therapy now. Because I don't think she understands like, why all of a sudden and, like, what I'm dealing. Like, it's, you know, she put me in therapy because of the divorce. And, like, that made sense. It's like, this happened, therapy. But she's like, what happened? And I'm like, nothing. Like, well, something. But, like, she doesn't know necessarily, like, why I'm doing it. And so she's kind of, like, freaked out by it. I don't think she thinks, she just definitely doesn't think it's, like, a bad thing. She doesn't think it, like, makes me weak.
Right.
None of the usual stuff that you maybe hear from parents. But it is confusing to her, yes, for sure.
I imagine she feels safety knowing she has as much information about her children as possible so that she can protect them in her mind.
Right.
What does your therapist say about the difficulty in your relationship with still wanting to protect your mom and her kind of still viewing you as a child?
She doesn't push me about it that much. I think her goal in general, and it's related to other issues where I have, like, a lot of trouble saying no in general in life, it has been to kind of, like, try to get me to, like, not care quite as much about my family's opinions, even though, like, they're generally pretty accepting, but to not feel obligated about a lot of different things has been her goal. So I think, I don't know, in terms of my mom, I'm like, does that make me, like, feel less obligated to tell my mom stuff? Possibly. But, like, she really has never pushed the issue of me being more open with my mom. But you're nodding your head like, yeah, that all makes sense, but I'm not sure it does.
No, I'm just listening.
Yeah,
okay. I'm just listening. Yeah, I actually wasn't even forming a thought right then.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I feel a lot of pressure in terms of my family when it comes to saying no to just anything, like, come to this thing. I'm like, I don't really want to or can't, and feel really bad about it for, like, a long time and stuff like that. It's more like what she has helped me with in terms of my relationship with my mom. But I really can't even remember most conversations we may have had about I mean, we definitely talk about how I feel the need to protect her, but I think she's like, that's kind of how, where you're at right now.
Yeah, it's a really hard one. It is a really, really, really hard one. And I battled that for a large part of my life. What are some phrases that, if you could pick two or three phrases that you wish you could say to any of your family members without it having a negative reaction and you being completely heard and understood, what would some of those phrases be?
I honestly don't know. At first I was like, there's nothing. I feel like I'm very open with them. I feel like I would maybe say, it's like hard to formulate because I feel like it would be something along the lines of, like, I don't have the same priorities that you do, and that's not, like, that doesn't mean I'm a bad person, maybe. Possibly. That. The other thing that immediately came to mind was, like, I smoke a lot of weed. Mm-hmm. Don't be mad at me. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of a, like, more frivolous one. But, yeah. It's really hard to think of those because I do feel very open and honest with them. And they're so good about so much. Like, unconventional career path and, like, what I've done, like, what I've chosen to do and, like, how I spend my time and things like that, they're, like, very chill with. But I think the thing that, you know, made me say my priorities are different is just, like, I feel like sometimes they feel, like, a very strong obligation to do certain things, and I just, like, don't feel those obligations. And, like, sometimes I'm like, does that make me a bad person? But, like,
God, no.
Therapy has really just been, like, no, it's just who you are and what you want to do.
That's so good that you're working towards that, because it is a hard thing to do, because it's not an intellectual exercise. It's an emotional exercise to get to the place where you feel like, you know, your relationship isn't going to collapse,
right,
if you speak your truth. And just anticipating the whatever, the yelling or the tears or the pouting or whatever a family dynamic is, it can be excruciating, excruciating. Yeah. Anything else that you'd like to share?
I don't think so. I mean, I feel like I really was surface level on a lot of the things that I was talking about. But I don't know how I could, like, go super deep on, like, something that lasted for, like, 6 years. Like, how many little things can you mention? You have the gist.
I don't feel like you were surface level.
Okay.
At all.
It's really hard sometimes to, like, describe who this person was. You know?
I think we get a pretty good
picture. I'm just like, do you realize how terrible he was? Like, sometimes I talk about it, and it's probably dictated a lot. Like I mentioned, I wrote about him online. I guess I could talk about that. But a lot of the reactions I got were kind of like, this isn't really that bad. And I'm like, you don't really know, I don't think.
You know, and he sounds to me like a troubled person, like a sick person that doesn't... you know, and maybe that's me making excuses for people because I think there's a difference. I think there's a difference. I look at a serial killer and even somebody that does the most horrible things, I believe 99.9% of humans don't want to do those things, but there's a compulsion, a sickness within them that they don't have tools to cope with that overwhelming compulsion, which should not alleviate any of their responsibility or any of the consequences. But that I had to get to that place with my mom to be able to, I guess, not take it personally. That sounds like an awful phrase. To heal, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's,
I understand.
Yeah.
I mean, as angry as I still feel, like, at the core of it, I'm always hoping that he's in therapy, and I get angrier when I sometimes realize he's probably not. Cause I do, like, I just, like, you could be helped. Like, this could really help you.
That angers the fuck out of me is the person that knows they have a compulsion that has proven they will hurt other people, and they're not actively doing everything they can to battle that.
Right. I think, like, there's a little bit of narcissism that's probably keeping him from, like, thinking he has a problem. But yeah, like, at the core of it, I do just really want him to be doing something to help himself, because I don't think he's evil. But he would just be greatly benefited by a therapist. But I
hope it didn't come across that I was trying to change your assessment of
it. Not at all.
I was just giving
how
I happen to view people that hurt other people. I actually sometimes get angrier at somebody that litters than I do at a serial killer, and it's so fucked up. Because I see the litterer is just not giving a shit, whereas the serial killer it can't fight this war within themselves, you know?
Yeah, I would agree.
Anything else that you'd like to share?
No, I can't think of where I would go if I were to continue.
I feel like we have a pretty complete episode, and I liked how it really, you know, kind of focused in on one or two main things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Sarah.
I mean, thanks for having me. It was hard, but it was good. So,
if people want to check out any of your stuff or get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that? We'll put these links up on the website as well.
I'm everywhere, but I mean, the content you would find is nowhere near what you found in this episode. It's all Disney. So if you like Disney, I'm on Twitter. It's all under Sarah Sterling, basically, now. My YouTube is Sarah Sterling. My Instagram is Sarah Sterling. So it's all
okay.
It's all there.
Good. Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you.
And that episode will soon be transcribed and available on our website. Many thanks to Accurate Secretarial for donating their time and helping out the show. And, of course, many thanks to Sarah as well. Before I take it out with a couple of surveys, I want to remind you guys there's a couple of different ways to support the show if you feel so inclined. This show is completely dependent on the kind contributions of you guys. You can contribute a one-time payment through PayPal, or you can do a monthly recurring payment
through either PayPal or Patreon. I recommend Patreon because then I can give you freebies. The interface on PayPal is god-awful. So you can sign up to be a monthly donor for as little as a dollar a month. And depending on whatever tier you donate at, you can be eligible to win stuff or listen to bonus content. But more importantly, it helps me keep doing the podcast. It's a full-time job, and it takes a lot of time, and I love doing it, but sometimes it gets a little scary financially because advertisers come and go. And you can also support us by using our Amazon link. If you're going to buy something at Amazon, use the URL. You can bookmark it. It's just click on the Amazon logo on our homepage at metalpod.com, and it'll take you right there. And then anything you buy on Amazon, they'll give us a little bit of money, and it doesn't make the price of what you're buying any more expensive. You can also help the podcast non-financially by spreading the word about it through social media. That helps. There was another way, and I can't. Oh, you can buy T-shirts. A lot of you have been buying the St. Herbert T-shirt, and it makes me smile every time I see we sold one, and the thought of somebody walking down the street with a St. Herbert T-shirt. Herbert is my dog that died in May and who was quite a character. And there was one other way that you could... I can't remember what the other thing was. But let's read some surveys. This is a survey from the young male abused by older female. And it's a survey that doesn't get filled out a lot, but I thought it was interesting timing that I read this. This was filled out the same week as this episode with Sarah. A lot of serendipity in this doing this podcast. And Kevin is straight in his 20s, was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. And he writes, when I was 15, I met a 22-year-old woman in World of Warcraft. The relationship became sexual in nature, as much as an online relationship can, and we ended up having a secret relationship until I was 18. When I was 21, I moved across the country to live with her. I believe she has borderline personality disorder based on several recurring behavior patterns that I can't fit in this one description. I kept her a secret for the longest time and kept her behavior and abusiveness a secret until after the relationship ended after 1 year of living together. Most of my family and friends still don't know the extent of it. I think I subconsciously knew it wasn't normal and didn't realize the severity of it until much later. I believe it has had a profound effect on me since it happened during such a formative time in my life. Remembering back, what feelings come up? Anger, regret, and sadness are the most common feelings I associate with this experience. I'm still in recovery now. Do you feel any damage was done? Damage was certainly done. My relationships still struggle because of what I experienced with her. Thank you so much for filling that out. Kevin, I appreciate it. And it's so good that you're on the path to recovering. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Gordy, and she writes, my parents died by murder-suicide when I was 16 years old. I was at school when it happened and chose to go back the next day. This led to my aunt and uncle caring for me for 5 months before deciding I was unhappy. They tried to send me to Virginia to live with my other aunt and uncle, which would have completely ripped away my entire support system. Had my parents not died and my aunt and uncle not tried to send me away, I wouldn't have found the most amazing adoptive family in my chemistry teacher and her family, who took me under legal guardianship. I often think I lost one family, but was lucky enough to gain another. That is profound, man. That is profound. It's, I mean... It's a cliche, but it's true. Our family is who we decide to let into our lives and who we can depend on. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Traumarama, and she writes, at the age of 19, I found myself pregnant, wanting to, quote, do the right thing. I kept the baby. Her father was only 18 at the time. We decided to stay together and raise her. But a few months before our daughter turned 2, she was diagnosed with autism. A year after that, her dad came out as gay, and I became a single mom. I spent the last 7 years struggling through my undergrad and then grad school while working and raising a child with special needs alone. Because of this history, I have often found myself isolated or feeling like I don't quite fit in anywhere. I live in San Francisco, where most people my age are childless, traveling, and finally enjoying some financial gains. They don't seem to understand my challenges, and I feel like an outsider so often. The people with children are usually older than I am and have not shared my experiences either. The dating scene has been a challenge, and I recently went through a breakup with someone I dated for 3 years. This summer, I found myself grappling with so much loneliness, there were times I thought I might actually die. Last week, I connected with another mom whose child attended that same social skills group as my daughter some months back. Her child is also on the spectrum, and she has recently gone through a divorce. So we've started to go out to dinner with our kids on occasion. Though this parent is older than I am, it has been such a relief to connect with someone who seems to, quote, get it, at least in some aspects. At the end of dinner last week, we left a restaurant, gaining stares from people as we walked out because both our kids had been loudly, vocally stimming, in parentheses, making loud noises they cannot control, throughout our meal. We just kept walking as I said some sarcastic comment about the looks we always get. We were making our way to our cars when our kids ran into the bookstore next to the restaurant. My daughter was flapping her hands excitedly, and her son went after the first book he found. We exchanged knowing glances only veterans of special needs parenting can understand when she suddenly said, "Have I ever told you about the time my kid took a spite shit on the playground?" Immediately we started cracking up as she explained the factors surrounding the spite shit and how other parents had come to chastise her for her son's behavior. Hilariously, I had a similar story of from my daughter's first day of kindergarten. She had become so angry that she peed in a trash can while her teachers looked on in shock. In the middle of this quiet bookstore, both our kids, being 100% themselves, we busted out in rolling laughter. Big belly laughs, tears in our eyes, and trying to catch our breath as we recounted these stories. Something that had felt so overwhelming, frustrating, and impossible to handle had suddenly become my bridge of connection to another human being. There was a time I would have never believed I could laugh at that incident, but there I was, taking in how bizarre and hilarious our lives can be. It also made me realize how far both our children had come. Stares in a restaurant feel like nothing when I look back at the gains we have all made. It was a small moment, but it restored my faith that I can connect with people, the good moments can come from seemingly terrible ones, and that our kids will be all right. Thank you for that. I can't imagine how challenging that has to be. I couldn't decide which of these next two to end the podcast on. I'm gonna have to read them in this order. This was an awfulsome moment filled out by a guy who calls himself an over-traumatic gay. And he writes, "I just got out of a 3.5-year relationship with an emotionally abusive and unavailable man. I moved across the country to Los Angeles with him a few months after we started dating and lived there together for 3 years. We were in the process of moving to New York City in the summer when I suddenly found out he'd been cheating on me with multiple men over the last few months. We ended things shortly after I moved back home to the East Coast with my parents. About 2 weeks after I moved back home, after crying nonstop for days, my ex called me to catch up. For whatever reason, he thought it would be nice to tell me he went on a 2-week dating bender and has made multiple new friends with benefits since I've been gone. He said he can't stop smiling, because he has the freedom to fuck whoever he wants and not feel guilty for hurting me anymore. After ending the call, I was in hysterics. I sobbed and cried for a long time until the tears slowly turned into strange laughter. I began laughing and smiling because hearing him say that made me realize how toxic this relationship was for me. I finally realized I'm worth so much more and deserve so much better. I finally realized I did nothing to deserve the hell he's put me through, and if anything, I almost feel sorry for him. I realized he must be in a lot of pain to do everything he's done to me. I called him a few days later to ask him to stop talking to me and blocked him on my phone and all social media. I'm still grieving and in a lot of pain, but I'm really proud of myself for standing up. It's making this process a lot more bearable. I gotta say, that is fucking amazing. A lot of people have to go to support groups for years to get the clarity and the strength to do what you did. And I commend you. Finally, this is a happy moment, filled out by a woman who calls herself Shut Up and Let Me Find My Depression Funny. And she writes, I've been really depressed the last few days. With an asterisk, takes a break to take her antidepressant. Last night, I slept only a few hours, and this morning I got up long enough to get my children to daycare. I got back into bed till past midday, crying constantly. I was upset over some hurtful things some jackass said, and in the midst of that, I found out a friend had passed away. I decided that nothing was going to get better while I was crying in bed, so I turned your podcast on and headed out into the garden. There's something about looking after the earth that fills me with so much joy, but I think I also find some satisfaction in ripping out weeds. I sat down for a rest right when you told the story of your friend transporting his own poo through someone's house. It was absurd and exactly what I needed to have a laugh. Listening to the podcast was the first time I'd laughed all day. My friend, that was when he was 12 or 13, and he was at my neighbor's house, and he had a crush on her, and he had to go to the bathroom, and he took a shit in their bathroom, and the toilet wouldn't flush, and he didn't know what to do, so he picked it up and ran to their other bathroom and put it in there and flushed it. And just the thought, like, if I could get in a time machine and go back and stop him between bathrooms and say, hey, Jim, this is Paul from the future, and I just want to let you know it's okay. You're not going to get caught. And what's even weirder is some lady who is almost suicidally depressed in 2017 is going to be gardening when she hears about this, and it's going to make her day. I want a time machine built just so I can do that, just so I can experience that. Well, I hope you heard something in this episode that moved you, enlightened you, inspired you, maybe pissed you off. Maybe you got some anger buried in you. You needed it to come up and out. Go ahead, take it out on me. Send me an angry email. I'm in a good place. I can handle it. If you're out there and you're feeling stuck, just don't give up, because one of the biggest lies our brains tell us is that we're alone and nobody understands, and it couldn't be further from the truth. You are so not alone, and there is help everywhere if we're willing to get out of our comfort zone and ask for it. And it may not come immediately, but it will come eventually. And it almost never comes in the form we want it to come in. And that's been my experience. And thanks for listening. That was a little dramatic right there.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way. Bizarrely.